U.S. stocks pushing higher to start the week as traders debate what the latest bout of volatility in crypto means for stocks, if anything. Welcome to Alpha Trader. Joining us now to discuss that and more is Henry Blodgett, co-founder and CEO of Insider Inc., which is a suite of publications with a global audience of more than 300 million people worldwide each month. Henry, welcome to Alpha Trader.
Thank you for having me. Great to be reunited with you.
It is great to be reunited with you. It's been way too long. Obviously, maybe not obviously, but from my point of view, the big story right now in the financial markets is what's happening with crypto. We had another mini crash over the weekend at Bitcoin. At one point, it was down 50% from its all-time high, although still up year-to-date. I should know that. And now rebounding sharply as we're talking here Monday morning. I want to read to you a quote from Mott Capital's Michael Kramer, and this came out of over a week ago. He wrote, "Bitcoin is telling us the risk sentiment of the market overall is shifting, and we care about Bitcoin because we care about risk sentiment," end quote. So what, if anything, should equity investors glean from what's going on with Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies more generally?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. It's great. And secondly, I should say that my view of the markets these days is very much from a distance. And certainly that's the way I've been viewing crypto as well. So I have very little to insight on what's going to happen next and so forth. But I think certainly it is fair to say that these big waves of sentiment up and down in crypto and in SPACs and in other areas of the market before that are giving you a sense of sort of the speculative mood and whether people are feeling optimistic or it's risk off or what have you. I think more broadly, crypto is behaving as a gigantic speculative bubble. And I remember in 2011, when I first got introduced to Bitcoin, I was sitting around a conference table at a conference with a bunch of venture capitalists. And they said, "Henry, we got to tell you about the next big thing." And I said, "I can't wait to hear. What is it?" They said, "Bitcoin." And that at that dinner, they explained, you know, why it was so powerful and cool and great technological design. And I think at that point, it was trading at about $80. And I remember somebody took some out of their wallet on their phone and passed it to the next person. And so people were passing it around. And I think the amount that was being passed around is certainly now worth millions of dollars. And so when I went back to New York after that, I thought about, okay, Bitcoin, you know, let's look at it. And so I took a deep look at it. And my conclusion then was, wow, if nothing else, this is the perfect asset for a speculative bubble. And the reasoning was it has all the attributes that you want in a speculative asset, which is there's a finite supply of it. It's hard to understand. It seems complicated. It's totally driven by supply and demand. And one thing that was very different about Bitcoin from the beginning and all of crypto from the stock market is that at least in stocks, people have this general idea that at some point in the future, a stock will trade at some reasonable multiple of its cash flow. With Bitcoin, there is simply no fundamental measure that could constrain the price. There is no way to say, wow, Bitcoin was expensive last week and now it's cheap. The only thing you're looking at when you say that is relative to its prior price. This asset could literally be worth anything. And so way back in 2011, I wrote about it and I said, look, this Bitcoin could be worth a dollar. It could be worth $1 million. It can certainly go to 1 million. I still believe that it's perfect. But I will say that what is different now is that back then the theory was that Bitcoin was going to be the next money. And that has now changed. Right. Nobody's talking about that anymore, particularly with Bitcoin. It's just a poor technological design for that purpose. It uses huge amounts of resources. It's really, really sort of inflexible. It has very limited transactions and so forth. So the story has changed. And now Bitcoin is the new gold. And I think Paul Krugman nailed it last week. And he's certainly been a Bitcoin skeptic. But he said, listen, it's been around for more than 10 to 15 years, 10 years rather. And it's still, there's nothing that anybody is using it for other than cross-border transactions or illegal transactions that is some big revolutionary thing. But gold also doesn't have that many uses, and certain people have been obsessed with it for thousands of years. So maybe Bitcoin will become this thing that people are obsessed with. And I think that that is possible for Bitcoin because it's such a brand name and so forth. So maybe Bitcoin does survive this and does okay over the long haul. I will say crypto more broadly, to me, it just looks like pure speculation. Right. Just looking at a list of the coins out there. I mean,
yes.
Boy, talk about
some of these altcoins. Well, thank you. Yes. So you know, there's a lot to unpack there. First of all, I got to tip my hat to you for, you know, seeing 10 years ago that this was, as you put it, you know, a perfect asset for speculative bubble. I don't know that we've had a lot of folks on here talking about crypto from various perspectives. I don't think anybody saw that 10 years ago that we're aware of. Is there any part of you, did you invest any at the time or subsequently?
No, do you wish you had?
Do you have any FOMO?
Yeah, that would have been nice and smart. I should have done it. I mean, what was funny then was that the conversations, again, you most people were arrayed on the perspective of this is so stupid. It's like Beanie Babies. It's just crazy. And what most people miss in that is that with an asset like Bitcoin at that level, there are scenarios in which it could go up 100x, 1,000x, 10,000x. And at the same time, all you can lose is 100%. And so actually, if you're just playing the odds, your odds, that is an incredibly attractive set of odds, as long as you don't bet more than you can afford. Because sure, you lose everything, that's fine. But if it goes up 100 or 1,000x, and so that's what it did. And so the people in those days have made just incalculable amounts of money. And some of them extremely wisely are diversifying into things like dollars and real estate. And they are the Bitcoin winners forever, for millennia. They've done what you're supposed to do if you get in early on a speculative bubble, which is ride it and then diversify into other things. My concern is for the folks who are finding out about it now and thinking that there's another 1,000x to go and they have to have it. And, you know, not to pick on poor Tom Brady, but when mm-hmm. Tom Brady's laser eyes were getting blasted around a week or two ago, there's one of those little signs like, maybe everybody who might buy this stuff already knows about it. And when that happens, that's often a sign that you're getting toward the end.
I'll just take the other side of the Paul Krugman argument. You know, you listen to a guy like Ross Stevens from NYDIG, right? He's not one of these kind of Bitcoin bro guys, right? He's not running around saying have fun staying poor, and not sitting around on Twitter with his laser eyes. But, you know, I believe speaks very eloquently about the uses for Bitcoin. And, you know, just last week, he was talking about a project they're doing with some company that's actually doing things in El Salvador, bringing banking to previously unbanked people or to people who previously had to face, you know, God knows what obstacles to cash a $100 remittance check from family that's living in the U.S., you know, paying 40% fees and traveling an hour and having the possibility of getting robbed on the way. And now they're actually doing it instantly with Bitcoin, costs, you know, of just a couple of basis points. Maybe there is some use. I don't think it works well as money, as you said, but maybe there is some use kind of beyond, you know, illegal activities and trading.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And that's why I mentioned cross-border earlier, is that was one of the early use cases that when you look at it, you say, okay, that I can see, that's different. And certainly with the huge fees in terms of transferring money internationally and so forth, you can see it. I still don't know how big that is. I don't know whether Bitcoin is ultimately going to be the cryptocurrency that is used for that. And the other thing I would say is that, again, there's this religious excitement about the fact that crypto in general and Bitcoin totally decentralized. There are no horrible organizations like banks or governments or anybody in the middle. It's just this wonderful, idealistic, perfect decentralized thing. I would say that for a lot of people, actually having some big institutions in the middle of financial transactions that you can sue if something goes wrong or what have you is a positive, not a negative. And I know, again, there are a lot of people who look at the Fed and they say, this is awful. They're wrecking money. They're rigging markets and all these terrible things. You know, again, like when I saw last week a story that the Fed was going to come out with its own cryptocurrency or at least research the idea, my reaction was, oh, finally, you know, something that isn't, you know, shadowy and underhanded and so forth is going to at least have a big institution that you can trust behind it. And so I think, Stephen, to your point, yes, there are uses and there certainly are some uses for blockchain. And so it is not those technologies will likely be with us. Again, I think, though, it is reasonable to say that you cannot determine some sort of fundamental value of Bitcoin or any other crypto. It is simply worth what somebody else will pay for it. And then again, as you say, all the folks with laser eyes or have fun staying poor or whatever ridicule will come out and say, oh, it's the same with fiat. And mm-hmm. So it's like, yeah, okay, it's the same with fiat. And yes, there is a bleed of inflation of a couple of percent a year. And sometimes in some countries, you get horrific inflation, destroys it. But in most countries, you don't. Gold has not done fantastically well over time. It turns out that the dollar has been a pretty good place to be for a very long time. And again, this idea that Bitcoin is a store of value is wonderful. And you look like a genius when the price is going up. When it drops 50% in 2 days, you look like a moron.
Right. So I want to go back. You know, you mentioned a couple of things there that I want to come back to, including what it sounds like is your trust in the Fed. We'll save that for maybe the second half of this conversation. You referenced in your, you know, your first comments about the similarities between what's going on in crypto and what happened with stocks in the dot-com era. For those who aren't familiar, you were a top-ranked analyst in the dot-com era. And then according to your official bio on insider.com, later keel-hauled by then Attorney General Eliot Spitzer over conflicts of interest between the research and banking divisions of brokerage firms. We won't go into all that history, but what are the similarities to you between what's happening today with crypto and what happened with the dot-coms in the 1990s? And what are the important differences?
Well, first, the price behavior for now crypto right now and SPACs the last year and so forth, sort of there's this rolling speculative mania that sort of lays waste to a particular asset class and then moves on to another one. That is extraordinarily similar to the second half of the 1990s as a whole, but in particular, the last 18 months of the boom from the fall of 1998 through the spring of 2000. It was very similar. You had tons of companies that would have been previously considered just utterly ridiculous, companies going public with nothing more than a business plan, not even any fundamental at all, trading at colossal valuations, stocks that like KTEL, which was an old music packager that was dead then. Suddenly somebody got a hold of it and it spiked and it was like a 30x in a week or something like that. It was the same thing that happened with GameStop. So it's very, very reminiscent of that. I would say what's different about crypto, again, is even in the midst of that, there were voices pointing out that eventually stocks are likely to trade at some multiple of cash flow that is relatively reasonable. And I know that the famous Keynes statement that he's credited with, which is, hey, the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. That is totally true. But it does often give you a sense of the potential downside, which for a lot of the dot-com stocks was 99.9%. And I would say exactly the same for the majority of crypto. You're going to lose everything if it breaks. And that ultimately, as I said before, there is no fundamental that I can identify that holds up under scrutiny for crypto, as in the thing that is ultimately going to prevent it from going to zero, other than what somebody else will pay for it. With stocks, again, eventually most stocks tend to trade 15 to 25 times earnings. That's where, you know, Apple and the big techs a bit above that, but not much. Tesla will ultimately be there. I know Tesla fanatics will say, no, that's crazy. It can trade at a gazillion X for whatever, but it'll eventually trade there. So they need earnings at some point, but you can't say the same with crypto. All it is what somebody else will pay for it. And as we've seen again and again, that can break. And so let me give you my view of it in the 1990s, and I was in print very clearly about this, saying, look, it looks like a bubble, and it probably is. And so let's look at what happened in prior bubbles. What happened is that most of the stuff goes to zero, but a few companies come through it and they go on to create this extraordinary value, because the internet is a profound trend that's going to change everything. And so my recommendation to investors at the end of the 1990s was, own a basket of the best ones, and eventually you should do okay. So was that decent advice? It was decent advice, it turned out, if your holding period was 15 years or more. The best advice by far would have been, it's almost certainly a bubble. Yes, a couple of companies will survive, but you're going to have a much better shot at them. So just sell everything and sit on the sidelines and watch the show for a while. And for any normal human who doesn't want to speculate all day and doesn't want to worry and so forth, that is just the best approach to crypto. It's just watch the show. It's fine. And meanwhile, take care of your retirement in other ways. And, you know, don't worry too much about inflation. You might get nicked. People do get nicked, but there are other assets like stocks that are pass-throughs, and eventually they reflect inflated currency and so forth. So you'll do okay. You don't need to be speculating. And then the other thing that I would say about the late 1990s, the big lesson to me, is I was saying that. I was saying, looks like a bubble, probably is. But I was thinking, you know, I hope there is a moment where I see something that is so clearly like bell ringing the top, can go to a sale on everything. And then I'll be a hero and we'll help our clients and everything else. And all I can say is there were many signs like that from 1995 through 2000.
Right.
That they're all, each one of them, oh my goodness, this has got to be the top. And then it wasn't. And
right.
Huge break in the fall of 1998, because some Asian economies collapsed. Everyone thought it was going. I just remember watching on the screen, like, oh my God, how can this be happening? Look at that. And then Alan Greenspan to the rescue, off to the races again, amazing 18 months after that. And the break in March of 2000 through April, where the NASDAQ fell by a third in 3 weeks, I will tell you, it felt exactly like this crypto break in the last week. I have no idea whether what's happening in crypto is the end. It may well not be. This is the way assets like this behave. There may be another 5 years, 10 years. I have no idea. But I will say that if I am right, that it's a speculative bubble, eventually when it begins to crater for the final time, it will feel just like this. And for the first third and the first half, folks with laser eyes and everybody else will be very, very, very convinced, pounding the table. We've seen this before. This is the greatest buying opportunity ever. Look at all these people with their weak hands getting blown out. Be smart. And they will pile in and they will suck a lot of other people in, and then they will get killed. Because as somebody said to me, it was a nice moment for me, learning about the downside of stocks in the late 90s, he said, you know, the great thing about companies that go out of business is it doesn't matter whether you short the stock when it's $5 or $3 or $1. When it's going to zero, it always has 100% downside. and that's what these things have. And so I just think that, again, what I would urge anybody who is speculating is you've just got to be prepared for to lose everything of what you're betting. And that doesn't mean it's bad. People get off and, oh, it's speculating, like it's some immoral thing. Give me a break. It's fun. It's super interesting. If you get it right, it can be fantastically lucrative extremely quickly. It's fun. There are many, many worse things to do with your time. But don't bet more than you can afford to lose.
Right, right. All right, so we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more with Henry Blodgett, CEO and co-founder of Insider Inc. You're listening to Alpha Trader. Welcome out to Alpha Trader. We are continuing our discussion now with Henry Blodgett, CEO of Insider Inc. and former top-ranked Wall Street internet analyst. And Henry, let's try to step away from this direct conversation about crypto. And what are your thoughts here about U.S. equity valuations, which are stretched by any historical measure, and yet the market seems to continue to keep going up, it's not going down much. May's been a rough month. We're still a few percentage points within all-time highs. Do you see evidence, as you just described in crypto, of speculative excesses and bubbles in the broader U.S. equity markets?
In short, yes. I think certainly what's happening in crypto is indicative of that. What happened in SPACs last year is indicative of that. And the SPAC thing has cooled. Certainly when you go back to the 1990s, end of the 1990s, and the beginning of the big crash in 2000, what happened was it was rolling from sector to sector. First, it was consumer internet. And by the summer of 2000, nobody ever wanted to own consumer internet again. And anybody who ever did was a moron. But, you know, that's never going to happen in storage, because storage is real, and chips and so forth, those are real. Well, one by one, over the next 6 months, those sectors all collapsed. It was dominoes. All the fundamentals broke down. And then, of course, we all realized the screamingly obvious thing, which was that the red hot IPO market was funding companies. Every company gets $100 million. You immediately spend $10 million on servers and $10 million on storage and $10 million on all these different things. That was really pumping up the fundamentals of everything. And so always very obvious in hindsight. When I look at the equity markets now, and this has been true for the last 6 years, and so this is a very cautionary tale for me too, which is that valuation historically has told you something about what your long-term returns are going to look like. It is useless from a near-term prediction point of view. And what I have really had hammered into my brain over the last 5 years is it's also pretty much useless from an intermediate term point of view. I mean, based on valuation, this market should have rolled over 3 to 5 years ago.
Right.
We haven't gotten there. And we did have our big dip last year, but there was a pretty clear reason for that. So what I would say is, I'll tell you what I am expecting. Based on every valuation metric that I have looked at that is cyclically adjusted, meaning that it takes into account that we have these super high profit margins right now, and that in the past, profit margins have tended to revert to means, takes into account that and so forth. I am expecting crappy equity returns for the next 10 years until we get a much lower price. And then I would expect good equity returns. I don't think the United States is going out of business. I think that American companies will continue to do well, and global companies. And so I do think equities are a great place to be for the long term. But I think the current pricing, which, as you point out, on pretty much every fundamental metric is way high. And by some measures, it is higher than it was in 2000 or close, and certainly higher than every other bubble peak. And there are some stories and theories about why things may have changed. Certainly the fact that interest rates are so low helps that.
Yes. And yeah, that's the big caveat for me is that in 1999, the 10-year was yielding 6%. And now it's at 1.6%. And we don't know if it's going to get through 2% anytime soon.
Totally true. And then all I would say to that, though, is Japan has had zero interest rates for practically 30 years, and the market has done terribly.
Right.
It's still below its level in 1990. So it's tough. But again, timing, I have no idea. I clearly, the market responds to liquidity. Everyone went hog wild over the past 6 months, looking forward to all the new stimulus and everything else. That seems to be kind of winding down. Like the surprise index seemed to be changing and coming back to the middle. So I don't, again, personally, I'm expecting crappy equity returns for the next 10 years. That's my prediction.
I wanted to just take it back to the late 90s, early 2000s. Is it your estimation that the bubble could have rolled further along had the Fed not begun tightening in 2000? Or in thinking about today, does this thing keep moving as far as the broader averages are concerned until the Fed actually tightens policy?
I think in 1999, as I recall, the Fed started tightening about 6 months before the break. And I remember people rationalizing it at the time, and they were right to, because obviously the broader market kept going up. But I think the even though the tech boom was pretty widespread, it did not affect the bulk of the economy. What we're seeing in the markets now is a little bit different in that pretty much everything is extraordinarily expensive relative to history. Whereas in the 1990s, it was really the tech sector and tech connected sector, and value was extraordinarily cheap and bonds were extraordinarily cheap. There were other things to invest in. And so folks who were excited about that could move into other assets and wait, and hopefully they didn't lose their job in the interim, which many, many, many people did in the late 1990s, because there is nothing. You have about 6 months as a professional manager before you are either fired or all your assets walk out the door because you're clearly not understanding what's happening and so forth. So I it's a good question on the Fed. I mean, where I look at the situation now is I can't see the Fed easing much more. And it's usually the direction that is the big driver rather than the absolute level. And I do think, first of all, the Fed is doing a marvelous job of trying to look extremely sober and saying, we also hate inflation. Of course, we would adjust at the time. You know, that's crazy. The Fed wants hot inflation for a little while, not 15%, but 5%, you know, something like that, to start to burn into this massive debt load that we've built up over the past 20 years. They want to run the inflation hot for a while. And so that's where the crypto guys are right. We really are set up for a period of much higher than normal inflation when things finally get going. And again, the Fed will talk a good game, but they will probably err on the side of let's let the economy run too hot for a while. Again, that sounds terrible, but equities are a pass-through. If you own equities, eventually, if inflation really works itself into the system, dividends will go up. You'll get that. It doesn't mean they do well, but if you look at the 1970s, those who got dividends and reinvested them and so forth, eventually they did okay, which is why I still am maintaining my retirement portfolio still has plenty of equities in it. So to me, the Fed is short term, and I do think they will let inflation run hot here when we finally get going.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are betting on that for sure. You mentioned earlier, you know, that people who held on to some of those consumer internet stocks ultimately did well if they had, you know, a very long time horizon of 15 plus years. You first came to prominence, if I recall correctly, with your bullishness on Amazon.com before it was obvious of what Amazon.com was going to become. As you look at Amazon today, how much more market share can they take? What do you think about the valuation of the stock? And I should ask, do you own any Amazon shares?
Yes, I still do. I bought it in 1998. And just to step back on that, because I mentioned it earlier about the basket. So my advice was, yes, it's probably a bubble. Own a basket of the best ones. Everything else maybe get killed, but you'll do okay over the long haul. And again, the flaw in that theory was that even the best ones got absolutely murdered, and several of them didn't actually survive the next decade. So in my personal basket, I had Amazon, Yahoo, and AOL. And I thought that those would survive. And the one that I regretted not having was eBay, because everybody thought eBay was terrific. And eBay did do well in the early 2000s for a while. But if you look at that, I was underwater for at least 10 to 15 years. First of all, everything else I had went to zero. I had way too much invested in all sorts of other crap, and it went to zero. Fortunately, eventually, this miraculous company called Amazon got me back even, and then actually made my late 1990s internet investments a good investment for a reasonable rate of return over decades. But boy, did it take a while. And boy, what do I wish I had bought Amazon at 10 instead of 100, which is where I bought it and was underwater for 7 years or whatever it was, 8 years. So now Amazon, I did sell some finally. And I feel like Amazon's growth profile has just got to change. Even if they continue to grow and do well, and they certainly seem to be an extraordinarily nimble company and extremely well run. Even if they do that, fundamentally, the growth has got to come down. I think because of the way they run the business, it's really hard to know what the embedded profitability ultimately is going to be. So I still have it, but I'm not expecting anything like the returns we've gotten over the past 5 years in it. I think they'll certainly be fine for a while with Jeff moving on to other things, but there aren't too many Jeff Bezoses out there.
Right.
You know, three to 5 years, we'll see how Amazon changes and what the regulatory things are and so forth. But
yeah, do they spin off the cloud business? Do you foresee that happening?
I think they'll fight it. I think that with a lot of big tech, there's going to be a lot more regulatory activity. There's going to be a lot of talk about monopolies, which don't really make sense. I mean, all of these markets that all these companies are in have many players and so forth. But anytime you get this level of concentrated power, people struggle against it. And so I think there'll be a lot more regulatory activity. So I just think for most of them, I'm not expecting much from them. I feel like they're solid, but I'm not expecting anything like what we've seen in the past from them.
Right. And you just remind me real quick, you know, the antitrust case against Microsoft back in 1999, early 2000 was very close to the peak. You know, we didn't mention that earlier when we were talking about that era, but I think there might've been some concern about that and the impact of more regulation and, government overreach, et cetera, et cetera. You also mentioned there's not that many Jeff Bezoses out there. Of course, that's true. I recall you and I in our old gigs at Yahoo talking about Tim Cook and the big shoes he had to fill with Steve Jobs. And at one point there was, we talked about how he was on a short leash and Wall Street was calling for his head because the stock didn't do well for 6 months. Obviously, he's done a phenomenal job at Apple, but a similar question I would ask you about Amazon, like, how much greater market cap do you think and market share do you think they can get? What's your outlook for Apple here?
Well, I think going back to Tim Cook first, because I think it is relevant. I do think he's done a phenomenal job, in part because he had such big shoes to fill. And the talk about Apple 5 or 7 years ago when Tim Cook took over, you'll remember that period where literally every year people were on the edge of their seats, like, okay, what's going to be the next iPhone? And there hasn't been the next iPhone. Tim Cook sucks. And what's so ludicrous about that is the iPhone is literally the best product in history that has ever been created by any company in terms of profitability and defensibility and so forth. It is a one of a kind. Apple makes lots of other products. None of them look anything like the iPhone. I mean, that was a once in a lifetime product. And even Apple, I would venture to say, had no idea what the iPhone would become when they rolled it out. And so the idea that is expecting anything like that is crazy. And so Tim Cook has done an extraordinary job. So going to Amazon, I mean, what nobody saw, including me in the 1990s, was AWS. And even Amazon didn't see it. But what Amazon has been able to do is spot these opportunities as they come along. There are still some massive opportunities that they're just starting to get into, like healthcare, for example, and other potential big things, payments. You know, are they in banking eventually? Sure, maybe they're in banking. Maybe that's easier. They're colossal markets. And so I do think that there are plenty of cases to say this company is going to continue to grow at a wonderful rate for a really long time. And that's why I haven't sold all of it. But I also think, again, the bigger they get, the harder it is to grow at compelling rates. We really don't know ultimately what the embedded profitability is. And the rest of big tech are likely to come under the same kind of pressure that Microsoft came under. You brought that up, which I think is also very relevant, which was basically for the 20 years ending in the 1990s, Microsoft's MO was kill everybody because that was the competitive thing. It's like, it's either you're going to kill me or I'm going to kill you. And that was their whole, the DNA of the company was just destroy everybody else. Then they got so powerful that people hated them for that. They had to become this nicer, gentler company or at least look at it. It may be the same thing for Amazon. When you just look at the all of the different constituencies that are building up against Amazon, even though people love the company, they don't like the market power and so forth. So Amazon may have to become a nicer, gentler company. And you know, that may have some implications down the road.
Now, Henry, you're obviously in the media business, and we, of course, had a mammoth media deal announced a week ago with AT&T going to spin off Warner Media's assets and combine that with Discovery, kind of create a new streaming, massive streaming player. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that and what that might mean for the Comcast, the Viacoms, the Netflixes of the world.
I think it was very smart to do it. AT&T buying Warner was like a huge facepalm. I mean, we've seen this around the tech and media industry forever, where tech or hardware, you know, jealous of the fabulous parties in Hollywood and so forth, and want to vertically integrate. And it is just
and the valuations, the parties and the valuations.
Yes, exactly. So whatever, worth trying, didn't work. At least they're getting out of it quick. But combining Discovery and Warner makes a lot of sense because of what Netflix has done to the industry, where Netflix's budget for programming creation is now bigger than anybody else in the industry. They have a direct relationship with everybody that's super powerful. So everybody else wants that. And the only way you have a real chance at that is through extraordinary scale, because there aren't going to be 42 streaming companies that have general programming and so forth. So it makes a lot of sense. I don't think it's a huge threat to Netflix. I think people keep saying that. The one thing that is very different about the programming business as opposed to technology is technology tends to be a winner-take-all game. The number one player often in a market will get 90% of the market. Number two will get 5%. And everybody else fights over the crumbs that are left. Programming and media is not like that. It's much more like retail, where there are always going to be hundreds, if not thousands, of programming companies. There will certainly be a big, wide range of share, and there are definitely economies of scale. So I think Netflix has a big advantage in that. But there's no way this market is going to suddenly be 90% Netflix and everybody else. It's just not going to evolve that way. So I think it's a smart deal. And I very much salute David Zaslav for watching from the sidelines with his tiny little Discovery while all the big elephants had such fun. And he has now just wielded his power and persuasiveness in a way that he has become the king of media. That's great.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's amazing. And he's that Hollywood guy, or he has those connections, which is what they're going to need, to your earlier point, right? No, AT&T didn't have those relationships with the stars and the agents. And obviously, I agree with you. I don't think it's winner take all. What's interesting to me is that people who would never get cable because it was too expensive, they cut their cord years ago, have a Netflix and a Disney Plus and an Apple TV and Hulu. And if you add it up, they're probably spending as much as they were spending on cable.
Yes, and it's not convenient. We were all going to say, oh, where's the perfect interface where anything I want is button away. And now you basically need a PhD to figure out how to operate.
It's brutal. Yes, we're just, you know, now we're sounding like the old guys, you know, can't work the VCR. Yeah. All right, Henry, really appreciate all your time this morning. Before we wrap, you mentioned, you know, a couple times back in the 1990s, late 1990s, you said own a basket of the best internet stocks. And you said similarly, if you were investing in crypto, that would be the way to go. And I'm curious if you have any thoughts on Coinbase, which is up Monday as we're talking here after an upgrade from Goldman Sachs, recent IPO. If you have any thoughts on that company or other, who are the other winners do you think may emerge in this crypto space?
If you want to have exposure to crypto, Coinbase seems a reasonable way to do it. I mean, that's I think there are a lot of advantages to that. What I recoil at when I hear it is this idea that you have to be in crypto. Like, right, you have to participate in the speculative mania, whatever it happens to be. You do not have to participate. You can construct just a normal, boring portfolio. And again, equities are inflation pass-throughs. Yes. If interest rates skyrocket, they're going to get kicked in the teeth and you're going to be down for a while. But if you were a long-term investor, just go back, look at the 1970s. The performance was horrendous in the 1970s, but if you kept reinvesting all the dividends, which went up and so forth, and now it'll be buybacks because it's more tax efficient, eventually you'll do okay. It's a pass through. So what I find just very funny is this idea that if you don't participate in crypto, you're going to be poor. Come on.
Right.
It's like saying if you don't go to the Kentucky Derby, you're going to be poor. I mean, it is a speculative orgy right now. You have probably 50-50 odds of being right. So that's good. And in the past couple of years where everything's been going up, your odds were better than 50-50. But then factor in tax. You know, tax is not nothing. That changes the odds when you finally decide to cash out a fair bit. Yep. So, again, if you enjoy speculating, this is fun. It's certainly dynamic. It's interesting. It's intellectually challenging. A lot of smart people and so forth. So it's very fun. There are many worse things you can do with your time, but you do not have to play.
Right. And if you do play, you make a great point. Even if you love the decentralized nature of crypto, you're still living in the US or other countries that have federal governments that are going to tax you. A great point. And on that note, our guest has been Henry Blodgett, co-founder and CEO of Insider Inc. Henry, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure.
Thank you, Henry.